makes you a separate being. This is, rather literally, to be spellbound. Naturally, it isn't the mere fact of being named that brings about the hoax of being a real person. It is all that goes with it. The child is tricked into the ego feeling by the attitudes, words, and actions of the society which surrounds him, his parents, relatives, teachers, and above all, his similarly hoodwinked peers. Other people teach us who we are. Their attitudes to us are the mirror in which we learn to see ourselves, but the mirror is distorted. We are, perhaps, rather dimly aware of the immense power of our social environment. We seldom realize, for example, that our most private thoughts and emotions are not actually our own. For we think in terms of languages and images which we did not invent, but which were given to us by our society. We copy emotional reactions from our parents, learning from them that excrement is supposed to have a disgusting smell and that vomiting is supposed to be an unpleasant sensation. The dread of death is also learned from their anxieties about sickness and from their attitudes to funerals and corpses. Our social environment has this power just because we do not exist apart from a society. Society is our extended mind and body. Yet the very society from which the individual is inseparable is using its whole irresistible force to persuade the individual that he is indeed separate. Society, as we now know it, is therefore playing a game with self-contradictory rules. Just because we do not exist apart from the community is able to convince us that we do, that each one of us is an independent source of action with a mind of its own. The more successfully the community implants this feeling, the more trouble it has in getting the individual to cooperate, with the result that children raised in such an environment are almost permanently confused. This state of affairs is known technically as the double bind. A person is put in a double bind by a command or request which contains a concealed contradiction. Stop being self-conscious. Try to relax. Or the famous prosecuting attorney's question to the man accused of cruelty to his wife, "Have you stopped beating your wife yet? Answer yes or no." This is a damned if you do and damned if you don't situation, which arises constantly in human and especially family relations. A wife complains to her husband, "Do you realize that since we were married 2 years ago, you haven't once taken me to the movies? It wasn't that way when you were courting. I think you're beginning to take me for granted." When the penitent husband returns from work the following evening, he says, "Darling, what about going to the movies after dinner?" And she replies, "You're only suggesting it because I complained." Society, as we now have it, pulled this trick on every child from earliest infancy. In the first place, the child is taught that he is responsible, that he is a free agent, an independent origin of thoughts and actions, a sort of miniature first cause. He accepts this make-believe for the very reason that it is not true. He can't help accepting it, just as he can't help accepting membership in the community where he was born. He has no way of resisting this kind of social indoctrination. It is constantly reinforced with rewards and punishments. It is built into the basic structure of the language he is learning. It is rubbed in repeatedly with such remarks as, "It isn't like you to do a thing like that," or "Don't be a copycat, be yourself." Or when one child imitates the mannerisms of another child whom he admires, "Johnny, that's not you, that's Peter." The innocent victim of this indoctrination cannot understand the paradox. He is being told that he must be free. An irresistible pressure is being put on him to make him believe that no such pressure exists. The community, of which he is necessarily a dependent member, defines him as an independent member. In the second place, he is thereupon commanded, as a free agent, to do things which will be acceptable only if done voluntarily. "You really ought to love us," say parents, aunts, uncles, brothers, and sisters. All nice children love their families and do things for them without having to be asked. In other words, we demand that you love us because you want to, and not because we say you ought to. Part of this nonsense is due to the fact that we confuse the must, expressing a condition, "To be human you must have a head," with the must, expressing a command, "You must put away your toys." No one makes an effort to have a head, and yet parents insist that, to be healthy, A child must have regular bowel movements, or that he must try to go to sleep, or that he must make an effort to pay attention, as if these goals were simply to be achieved by muscular exertion. Children are in no position to see the contradictions in these demands, and even if some prodigy were to point them out, he would be told summarily not to answer back, and that he lacked respect for his elders and betters. Instead of giving our children clear and explicit explanations of the game rules of the community, we befuddled them hopelessly because we, as adults, were once so befuddled, and remaining so, do not understand the game we are playing. A double-bind game is a game with self-contradictory rules, a game doomed to perpetual self-frustration, like trying to invent a perpetual motion machine in terms of Newtonian mechanics, or trying to trisect any given angle with a straight edge and compass. The social double-bind game can be phrased in several ways. The first rule of this game is that it is not a game. Everyone must play. You must love us. You must go on living. Be yourself, but play a consistent and acceptable role. Control yourself and be natural. Try to be sincere. Essentially, this game is a demand for spontaneous behavior of certain kinds. Living, loving, being natural or sincere, all these are spontaneous forms of behavior. They happen of themselves, like digesting food or growing hair. As soon as they are forced, they acquire that unnatural, contrived, and phony atmosphere which everyone deplores. Weak and scentless, like forced flowers, and tasteless, like forced fruit. Life and love generate effort, but effort will not generate them. Faith in life, in other people, and in oneself is the attitude of allowing the spontaneous to be spontaneous, in its own way and in its own time. This is, of course, risky, because life and other people do not always respond to faith as we might wish. Faith is always a gamble, because life itself is a gambling game with what must appear, in the hiding aspect of the game, to be colossal stakes. But to take the gamble out of the game, to try to make winning a dead certainty, is to achieve a certainty which is indeed dead. The alternative to a community based on mutual trust is a totalitarian police state, a community in which spontaneity is virtually forbidden. A Hindu treatise on the art of government, the Arthashastra, lays down the rules of policy for the complete tyrant, describing the organization of his palace, his court, and his state in such fashion as to make Machiavelli seem illiberal. The first rule is that he must trust no one and be without a single intimate friend. Beyond this, he must organize his government as a series of concentric circles composed of the various ministers, generals, officers, secretaries, and servants who execute his orders, every circle constituting a degree of rank leading up to the king himself at the center, like a spider in its web. Beginning with the circle immediately surrounding the king, the circles must consist alternately of his natural enemies and his natural friends. Because the very highest rank of princes will be plotting to seize the king's power, they must be surrounded and watched by a circle of ministers eager to gain the king's favor. And this hierarchy of mutually mistrusting circles must go all the way out to the fringe of the web. Divide et impera. Divide and rule. Meanwhile, the king remains in the safety of his inmost apartments, attended by guards who are in turn watched by other guards hidden in the walls. Slaves taste his food for poison, and he must sleep either with one eye open or with his door firmly locked on the inside. In case of a serious revolution, there must be a secret underground passage giving him escape from the center, a passage containing a lever which will unsettle the keystone of the building and bring it crashing down upon his rebellious court. The Arthashastra does not forget to warn the tyrant that he can never win. He may rise to eminence through ambition or the call of duty, but the more absolute his power, the more he is hated, and the more he is the prisoner of his own trap. The web catches the spider. He cannot wander at leisure in the streets and parks of his own capital, or sit on a lonely beach listening to the waves and watching the gulls. Through enslaving others, he himself becomes the most miserable of slaves. Nothing fails like success, because the self-imposed task of our society and all its members is a contradiction. to force things to happen which are acceptable only when they happen without force. This, in turn, arises from the definition of a man as an independent agent, in the universe, but not of it, saddled with the job of bending the world to his will. No amount of preaching and moralizing will tame the type of man so defined, for the hypnotic hallucination of himself as something separate from the world renders him incapable of seeing that life is a system of geological and biological cooperation. Certainly, the system contains fights: birds against worms, snails against lettuce, and spiders against flies. But these fights are contained in the sense that they do not get out of hand, that no one species is the permanent victor. Man alone is trying to eliminate his natural enemies in the conviction that he is, or should be, the supreme species. Just as we cultivate vegetables, cattle, and chickens for food in the realization that we depend upon these creatures for our life, we should also realize that enemy creatures which prey upon man, insects, bacteria, and various fungi, are in fact enemy/friends. A New York hostess, entertaining a statesman from Pakistan, brought up the problem of the urgent need for birth control in Asia and what was being done about it in Pakistan. She was utterly nonplussed with the reply that all the propaganda about birth control was merely the white man's attempt to maintain his superiority over the colored races. I told her that she should have answered, "No, indeed. We only want to help you to prune your beautiful fruit trees." For the enemy/friends of man are his pruners. They prevent him from destroying himself by excess fertility, so that a person who dies of malaria or tuberculosis should be honored at least as much as one who has died for his country in battle. He has made room for the rest of us, and the bacteria which killed him should be saluted with proper chivalry as an honorable foe. The point is not that we should forthwith abandon penicillin or DDT. It is that we should fight to check the enemy, not to eliminate him. We must learn to include ourselves in the round of cooperations and conflicts, of symbiosis and preying, which constitutes the balance of nature, for a permanently victorious species destroys not only itself, but all other life in its environment. The obvious objection to an argument against wiping out such natural enemies of man as cancer or mosquitoes is our sympathy for the individuals who get caught. It is all very well to reason, in the abstract, that the human population has to be pruned, but when disease puts its finger on me, I run for the doctor. What would be the success of a call for volunteers for pruning? In Western civilization, we do not abandon sickly babies, shoot the insane, let the hungry starve, or leave diseased people to die on the streets, at least not in our better moments. For the most sacred ideal of our culture is the right of every individual to justice, health, and wealth, or life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To suggest that the personal ego is a hallucination seems to be an attack on this most sacred value, without which civilized people would fall back to the level of coolies or ants to become an organized mass where the particular person is expendable. During World War II, a friend of mine used to fly Chinese laborers over the hump to work on the south end of the Burma Road. The long flight was, of course, ideal for gambling, but since there was not enough cash between them to make the game interesting, the stakes were that the final loser should jump off the plane. No parachute. Our natural reaction is that such people aren't fully human. Like the families and servants of ancient kings who were buried alive with their deceased lord, they seem, as Thomas Mann suggested, to be faces with no back to their heads, mere masks, mere roles of no further use or meaning, bees without a queen. Whatever villainies the British may have committed in India, their Christian consciences balked at the practice of sati, which required a widow to commit suicide at her husband's funeral. Truly, civilized people are, we feel, not faces on the sky, but fully enclosed heads containing souls, each one of infinite value in the sight of God. At one extreme, then, we have the sacred individual, the unique personal ego, separate from both nature and God, defined as such by a society which, almost in the same breath, commands him to be free and commands him to conform. At the other extreme is the coolie, the cog in the industrial collectivist machine, or the mere hand, as the factory worker is often called. If one believes that the personal ego is a natural endowment of all men, as distinct from a social convention, then the lot of the coolie is bleak indeed, for one sees him as a repressed and frustrated person, though his own society may never have defined him as such. However, there is a third possibility. The individual may be understood neither as an isolated person nor as an expendable humanoid working machine. He may be seen, instead, as one particular focal point at which the whole universe expresses itself, as an incarnation of the self, of the Godhead, or whatever one may choose to call it. This view retains and indeed amplifies our apprehension that the individual is in some way sacred. At the same time, it dissolves the paradox of the personal ego, which is to have attained the precious state of being a unique person at the price of perpetual anxiety for one's survival. The hallucination of separateness prevents one from seeing that to cherish the ego is to cherish misery. We do not realize that our so-called love and concern for the individual is simply the other face of our own fear of death or rejection. In his exaggerated valuation of separate identity, the personal ego is sawing off the branch on which he is sitting, and then getting more and more anxious about the coming crash. Let it be clear, furthermore, that the ego fiction is in no way essential to the individual, to the total human organism, in fulfilling and expressing his individuality. For every individual is a unique manifestation of the whole, as every branch is a particular outreaching of the tree. To manifest individuality, every branch must have a sensitive connection with the tree, just as our independently moving and differentiated fingers must have a sensitive connection with the whole body. The point, which can hardly be repeated too often, is that differentiation is not separation. The head and the feet are different, but not separate. And though man is not connected to the universe by exactly the same physical relation as branch to tree or feet to head, he is nonetheless connected, and by physical relations of fascinating complexity. The death of the individual is not disconnection, but simply withdrawal. The corpse is like a footprint or an echo, the dissolving trace of something which the self has ceased to do. If, then, the differentiation of individuals is of great value, on the principle that variety is the spice of life, this value is not going to be enhanced by a self-contradictory definition of individuality. Our society, that is, we ourselves, all of us, is defining the individual with a double bind, commanding him to be free and separate from the world, which he is not, for otherwise the command would not work. Under the circumstances, it works only in the sense of implanting an illusion of separateness, just as the commands of a hypnotist can create illusions. Thus bamboozled, the individual, instead of fulfilling his unique function in the world, is exhausted and frustrated in efforts to accomplish self-contradictory goals. Because he is now so largely defined as a separate person, caught up in a mindless and alien universe, his principal task is to get one up on the universe and to conquer nature. This is palpably absurd, and since the task is never achieved, the individual is taught to live and work for some future in which the impossible will at last happen, if not for him, then at least for his children. We are thus breeding a type of human being incapable of living in the present, that is, of really living. For unless one is able to live fully in the present, the future is a hoax. There is no point whatever in making plans for a future which you will never be able to enjoy. When your plans mature, you will still be living for some other future beyond. You will never be able to sit back with full contentment and say, "Now I've arrived." Your entire education has deprived you of this capacity because it was preparing you for the future instead of showing you how to be alive now. In other words, you have been hypnotized or conditioned by an educational processing system arranged in grades or steps, supposedly leading